are you?
I'm tired.
Aren't we always?
Yeah, but there's levels. There's levels of tired.
Extenuating circumstances to tired.
I feel like there's tired from when you didn't do much and you just kind of sat around all day and you didn't use your brain. And then there's tired from using your brain too much. And there's probably some other types of tired, but I don't remember because I'm too tired.
Okay. Would that be, do you want to publicly announce anything about why you might be tired now?
I don't know. Do I?
Okay. It's up to you.
I have a job.
Yes.
I have a regular job now and I have to go to
I believe the preferred nomenclature is a jobby job.
I don't like that phrase. I don't use that phrase.
Okay.
It's weird. Or a J-O-B job or whatever these people. That sounds, oh God. I already sound terrible coming out of my mouth.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I got to go talk to people all day and, you know, be around people and, you know, not pet my dog and sit in my office here at my home. So, yeah, I'm a little fried. It's day two of the job, but it's fine.
It's okay. It just gets worse. But the important thing to know is that you figured out that there's a Shake Shack nearby. So
I did discover that the Scottsdale Fashion Square Mall is in a close enough proximity to the office that I can zip on over there and get me a chicken sandwich, despite the fact that they no longer sell their hot chicken sandwich, which is heartbreaking to me because it was so good.
I never had the hot chicken. I only had the regular.
It's so chicken. Much better.
Okay.
It's got all the flavor and a little bit of spice. And the dude behind the counter is like, I don't know, there's like Louisiana hot sauce over there that you can put on your chicken sandwich if you want to try and make your own. It's like, sir, that is not the same thing. Where is the slaw? Where is the cayenne pepper?
Man, you are not a happy camper.
I was heartbroken. I drove all the way to the mall by myself. I parked. I walked. I waited in line with the little beeper guy that vibrates to let me know when my meal was ready. And I couldn't even get a spicy chicken sandwich.
Wow, you parked and you walked. That's crazy.
It's true. I didn't take a bird scooter. I didn't take a ride share or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Man.
What'd you have for lunch today?
I went to a chain restaurant known as Luna Grill for my restaurant from my office.
It sounds fancy. Sounds like something that would be an Entourage.
It is not either of those things that you mentioned. That being fancy or in Entourage. It is how should I put this? Kind of like fast Greek-ish, Mediterranean-ish kind of thing. I don't know if they
is it like a Zoe's? Do you have Zoe's out there?
No, we had Daphne's. I think that was the big Greek chain that everybody knew about for a while, but then Daphne's kind of went away and was replaced by Yala's or Yada, something with a Y. But
San Jose, there was a place called Yayasu's, which was like a Greek restaurant in a Burger King.
Mm.
It was good.
Yeah. No, this is a place where...
I was just about to tell you a story about a time I ran into a coworker there that I just realized you don't know at all.
Well, that probably would have been entertaining had I known them, but...
Oh, yeah, no, that was the place I ran into Jack. You remember Jack, right?
No, I don't remember Jack.
You've never heard me mention Jack in my entire life.
In either of the multiple meanings of the word Jack, but, yeah, no.
Like the cheese?
Yes, like the cheese.
The cheese dines alone at Yayasu's.
Oh, man. So, I'm glad I could brighten your day by introducing you to a bad movie that I had selected as a bad movie and prefaced as a bad movie and presented to you as a bad movie. And somehow, I think maybe you underestimated my ability to say this was bad. I think... You might have been maybe thinking that I was like pulling the punch or something. Like
no,
that. I was
I
like
think,
being nice because it's like like Star Trek bad, but like this is like bad.
Well, no, I think that's the point right there, that I have not yet fully come to understand what Star Trek bad means, because you can have a bad movie where stuff doesn't really make sense or is a little like cheesy or whatever, but like stuff is happening and like there's a story there and you're like, yeah, whatever, it's a story. But since Star Trek is so like out there and it's like, what could possibly happen next? And it's like, oh, they're going to go to the God planet to find the origin of civilization and talk to the Wizard of Oz inside a bunch of baby back ribs that popped out of a planet. Like, there's a different level of badness that comes out of Star Trek that I'm not prepared for. I don't have the history of it. I didn't watch much of the show. I've seen bits of the show. So I don't, when you say it's a bad movie, it's not just that it's a bad movie, it's Star Trek bad, which means it's going to be completely incoherent, and in the case of this movie, it is just going to be very self-serving for Mr. Shatner to you know, bang on his chest and go, no, I stand in opposition to these challenges, and I will not be moved from my beliefs, I am the captain. And such, and everyone else goes, oh, Kirk, wow. And then he goes, yes, that's right, I'm very important.
Isn't it amazing how much of this movie manages to be entirely about him?
It's, yeah, like, all of the characters, well, for the first, like, third of the movie, all of the characters are speaking with Shatner's voice, and then after that, they're all speaking in, like, the most flattering way that they could possibly, like, they're just lobbing softballs right for Shatner so he can just crank them out of the park and say, yes, look at me, I am important over here. And they're like, oh gee, thank you captain and stuff, and we are too weak and our minds have been molded by this weird con man, and but you are strong and we will follow you because you are our leader. Oh god, it's so stupid.
Yep.
It's so beyond transparent too. Like, it's pretty obvious what he did here.
Yeah,
and he's full like Shakespearean. What do you call the weird Shatner cadence that people make fun of him for? Like he's really going for that here with the dramatic pauses and like the machine gun bullet speeches, and then just the weird emphasis on words and stuff.
Yeah, because he decided that this was going to be a referendum on televangelists and their claims that they believe in God and how they use that to manipulate people. Televangelists.
He's speaking to me directly.
Yeah, televangelists were huge in the 80s. Now, you may not have detected any of that from the movie, because I sure didn't when I had first seen this movie. And this is a movie that also manages to throw in a bunch of other stuff, and that's mostly to either try to Star Trekify the outline Shatner had, or to diffuse some of the Shatner onlyness that existed. Because when we start this movie, it's all about Shatner, and everything from there was all about Shatner. And in the original like drafts of this, like everyone gets brainwashed and Shatner's just by himself and he has to save everyone by himself.
None but me can intercede. Is that the phrase?
Yeah, I believe Nimoy and DeForest Kelly had some objections to this. And so
Bones is very not grumpy Bones in this movie. He's just like, oh my goodness, what's going on here? He's not like surly, you know, kind of hungover, grumpy guy on the ship.
Yeah, I would say there's a harder edge to him in the other films. In this one, everyone is kind of played for laughs when they cut to them. They're sort of a caricature of themselves, especially Scotty and Uhura. They get probably like the least. And then Sulu does things, but says almost nothing, comparatively speaking.
He gets lost in a forest and then has some terrible dialogue into his communicator.
Yeah. Well, yeah. No, that the terrible dialogue was from Chekhov, because apparently...
Oh, there was all of it.
Yeah, it seems like Shatner liked the Chekhov kind of accent-y kind of thing, like it's a funny joke kind of whatever. But
nuclear vessels.
Yeah, etc. But that doesn't seem to carry really through the whole thing, and it sort of undermines, especially when he's trying to be serious, for the part where he's pretending to be the captain of the Enterprise. That happens later. So all of the character performances are really undermined by Shatner's outline and decisions with his discussion with the writer of this, who was a writer for Star Trek the Motion Picture, which was not well received by anybody. This was supposed to be sort of similar. You got a God situation. You got a thing you got to go through. You do the thing. You talk to God. You say, "Hey, you're not God," and then you get out of there. And that's kind of what underpins this. Gene Roddenberry hated the script, but not for like dialogue reasons, for like the theme reasons and like the reasons why like God, etc. Which is funny because it seems to be in the list of things that Gene Roddenberry hated just because he was jealous that he was not producing these films. Harve Bennett was brought back as producer. He didn't want to do it initially, but Shatner convinced him to come back as producer because he's like, "Hey, come on back." Because apparently Harve Bennett didn't feel like he was family on Star Trek, and had a bit of a disagreement with Leonard Nimoy when they were doing Star Trek 4. So, whatevs. But he comes back, and he not only produces this, but he is in it for a cameo as the head of Starfleet that Shatner talks to.
Oh, the guy who's like sitting awkwardly on the edge of a couch or whatever they call table. Shatner on the thing?
Yeah, he sits on the edge of a table. So he's here producing this again. Ralph Winter's back as producer, and he's trying to handle all the things, but he, of course, knew that ILM was busy and booked with Ghostbusters 2 and what the F other... They did something else in 1988.
It's Indiana Last Crusade.
Yes, Last Crusade. Okay, so they were busy, so Ralph Winter couldn't use them, and he's like, "Well, what are we going to do?" And he solicited bids from everybody else. And one of the bids was from Bran Faron. And this is interesting because...
Johnny Quest's dad.
Yeah, you might be thinking, what is Bran Faron known for? And the answer would be not much, but it's...
Yeah, what is he known for? He's a technologist.
Yeah.
He did some Disney Imagineering. He made some dinosaur robots that move around.
If you Google his name, you'll find out that he is the guy who invalidated... Apple's pinch to zoom patent because of his multi-touch patents.
Is he really?
Yes.
Oh no. Oh. He's,
I mean, I can't say enough about what a weirdo he is. And if you go to his Wikipedia page, it's all about his public speaking engagements. And it's like, did someone who does his public speaking engagements edit this Wikipedia page? But Bran Faron, maybe more capable of talking than doing is something I'm going to say, because he managed to convince everyone that he could pull off a Star Trek movie with all the complicated motion control camera work that needs to occur for this. Because with these shots, it's not just like one pass. You got to do several passes in order to generate the mats, the lights on the ship, the general luminance of the actual surface. Like, you could think of it as like a diffuse pass on the hull, that sort of thing. They got to do multiple passes and put them all together. And they got to a point where Bran Faron was just like, let's skip that one. Let's just do this one. And let's sandwich these things together as fast as possible. So it got a little underwhelming. And all of his visual effects stuff, it was all based in the New York City area, with stuff happening in New York and in New Jersey. And they would send things back to Shatner, and Shatner would be a little dismayed To his credit, he knew they weren't good, but he wasn't able to do anything about it because he booked these guys and sent them the Enterprise model. So there you go. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, but
interesting.
Something I found out before we started recording was that you mentioned to me in a brief aside, and I said, save it for the podcast. I don't even want to know. I don't even want to know right now. You mentioned to me that you had met Bran Farron and had Bran Farron stories. So I want to hear what that could possibly be.
I spent about 5 hours with him at his office, Applied Minds Inc., which is kind of catty corner across the street from DreamWorks. Back in 2007, 2008, we were over at Intel. We were making a documentary about the history of microprocessors in filmmaking, and one of the senior fellows at Intel happened to be one of the basically the guy who built the camera sync rig for Superman, the movie, that basically synced up the projector and the little robot arm that moved Christopher Reeves around in the camera and all that stuff, so it looked real. And we were getting his perspective. And then I guess he somehow knew Bran from back in the day, so he hooked up the interview there. So we went over to Applied Minds. He wandered us around. He showed us his little half a robot dinosaur. He showed us that giant, weird truck thing that he made. I don't really know what you call it. It's like an off-road vehicle that's like a house and like a research station or something. And then we interviewed him for about an hour, and I think the key takeaway here is that we spent probably about 20 minutes between him and our crew arguing over what the first use of microprocessors in cinema was, because he got the year wrong on whatever movie he claimed was the first one to use microprocessors in film, and he ultimately was turned out to be wrong and had to, like, you know, re-record his thing because it was actually Superman. But you know, he's interesting. He always wears that Johnny Quest jacket thing he's got going on there, like he's on safari even though he's in Glendale. But he's very interesting, I suppose. He's got stories and a beard.
Yeah,
it's weird. Like his office looks like if you mixed like somebody from Jumanji with like Iron Man. Like, he has a lot of money and like a lot of free time to like think of ideas and like play around with stuff. But then he's just kind of like wandering amongst this sort of like playpen of like half built stuff in this weird little warehouse behind his actual office. It's very strange.
Half built stuff sounds about right for him. You know, just say
it. It's very fascinating to go like, wow, look at all this stuff you seem to be working on. But I just found this article on Wired about the big truck thing he was building, and the article is from 2014, and he was working on it in 2007, so I don't know. Maybe he just takes his time with things.
It's not happening. He's bad. I'm just gonna say it. He says that he can do things and then he doesn't do them, so.
Well, he made some robotic dinosaurs. At the time, I didn't know who he was, and I was told like he was like a Disney Imagineer guy, an ex-Imagineer.
Yeah, well, I think it was easier for him to BS his way through certain things when he was working on music videos a lot, and then when he gets larger projects where there's more work that's involved in actually making them tangible for a duration of time, then he kind of like falls down and can't do it.
I mean, he has a very wide range of work and interests, which I guess is a credit, or is interesting at least.
Yeah, or a symptom of someone who can't focus.
Yeah, there's that.
Yes.
Yeah, there's that. Anyway, you know, they were nice.
Uh-huh.
They were kind enough to let us wander around and look at stuff.
Yeah, which is curious about this movie, because the cinematography by Andrew Laszlo and set design by Herman Zimmern and the, well, everything else that was going on, makeup even, it was far more sophisticated than what Star Trek had previously to this film. But at the same time, the visual effects had taken a step back, because you can just look at these and just see, like, these are janky. Like, you can see a matte line around this. You can see, like, the lack of definition in things. You can see grain in some of these, like, fantastical effects that are occurring because you've...
Yeah, there's a lot of grain in some of the, like, orangey, sunset-y, like, fiery stuff.
Yeah, also in the Great Barrier stuff where they're, like, obviously zooming in on footage where they may not have shot it with large film stock. Like, ILM uses... At the time, I think they used... I want to say VistaVision, but I could have that wrong.
Well, that sounds about right.
Yeah, other large format things where it's just like, yes, this is larger than the film print negative that you would use for your film, but you're going to crop in on it or shrink it down or do something with it. So it needs to be that way. It seems like Bran Faron didn't really account for any of these things when he was doing this stuff and just talked a good game when he was getting the job. Having said that, no amount of good visual effects would have saved this film from the writing, which...
Oh, it's so bad, which is weird, though, because, and you know, a lot of this, we mentioned that it's very self-serving, and Shatner was directing this and you know, starring and getting to use as much of the screen time as he wants. I feel like he's a relatively competent director in terms of, like, moving cameras and well, some of the staging is very weird, where it's like the people aren't centered in the frame and we're staring at the backs of their heads. Like, what was it, like, in one of the elevators or something? Mm-hmm. It was very weird. But I actually like a lot of the dynamic movement he brought to some of this stuff. I assume he did it. Maybe the cinematographer did it.
It's a coin toss on that one for me. But the he certainly didn't bring the quality to working with the actors that Leonard Nimoy brought in the prior two films.
No, and that's probably one of the other reasons that everyone other than Shatner in this movie is just kind of like there, and it almost looks like they're doing their rehearsal and the camera just happened to be rolling.
Yeah. So Shatner basically got to do this because of, like, a favored nations clause thing from back when they did the original series. And, he's like, I don't want Leonard Nimoy to be more famous than me. they negotiated.
That's not how it goes. It was all just about equality amongst the stars of the picture.
Yeah. So they negotiated this thing where he gets paid the same, no matter what, if one of them gets a raise, the other one gets a raise, et cetera. And Leonard Nimoy had directed 3 and 4, and in his agreements to do 4, Shatner said, I want to direct 5, and so they stupidly agreed to that, not realizing that perhaps Leonard Nimoy could maybe get performances out of these actors that were good, and that he understood sort of a balance of things, and that Shatner did not understand a balance of things, and that everything Shatner did would be Shatner-centric.
Although, lucky for them, Spock brother, Cyborg, whatever, Cyborg Bach, he's a very charismatic actor and had a lot of energy and really, you know, held his own on screen, I think.
I deeply dislike Lawrence Luckenbill as Cyborg.
Well, I mean, his character is absurd and weird, but he at least has the energy to, like, sort of compete on screen.
Yeah, but they don't hit what Kirk was. They don't hit what Shatner was going for with trying to make it seem like this was a televangelist. He didn't seem like a televangelist. He just seemed like a dude.
He doesn't start to get weird until you get the creepy brainwashy stuff, way down the line on the Enterprise.
Yeah. So. I never really cared for him. And, you know, I don't necessarily fault him as an actor, because I'm sure this is the performance that he was directed to portray, because it's not like the other actors where they're portraying a character they've been doing for years. Like, this is something that was made up just specifically for this movie.
He's the feeling Vulcan.
Yeah. But he has a weirdness about him that I don't care for. But the movie starts with him, and we have a dirt field full of holes and a guy without like good teeth, and he meets a guy running in on a horse, and that guy
in
takes
slow motion.
Oh god, I don't know why the slow motion. Why? What was the reason? This isn't Lawrence.
Add dramatic effect.
I was gonna say this is not Lawrence Arabia. So he shows up. He takes off his little breather thing to keep the dust out. As we watch all of the composited 2D dust move with the camera, because of course it would move with the camera because they just didn't match move things. Because you couldn't, I guess. And they would talk to each other about the things, about the pain, the heartbeat stuff, and then it's like, oh, you're laughing, you're a Vulcan, ah ha ha ha. And then the camera pans up, and we get the Star Trek fanfare that had originally been heard in Star Trek The Motion Picture, which we have not watched, but since then had not been heard in any Star Trek film in the intervening years. So basically from 1970, whatever it was, until 1989, fans had not heard this music used for this. What they had heard this music used for was Star Trek The Next Generation's opening titles. So as a kid who watched Star Trek The Next Generation first and then watched the Star Trek movies, because I wouldn't have seen this because I was a kid, that it was always weird to me that it had the same sound as the other thing, because they weren't using the same thing. But whatevs. I'm sure that did not distract you. And there is
really the subtle differences in Star Trek music cues is going to distract me.
I don't know. Maybe you got deeply attached to James Horner's work, but probably not.
I met him too.
I know, you told me about that.
It was literally part of that same project, because it was about microprocessors and audio recording.
Oh, wow, it was the same thing?
Yeah, it was the same video. It was a very bad video.
But he had the thing about the Macs and the PCs, because...
yes,
yeah.
One of each, one for work, one for porn. He was kidding, but that's... what he said.
Was he kidding?
I had the tapes from that interview.
Was he kidding?
He had a very dry sense of humor, so it's hard to tell.
Yeah. So anyway, this movie. This is the first time you hear Jerry Goldsmith again, and he does the opening titles. And then we go in on Yosemite, or more accurately, a painting of a sunrise at Yosemite or something. And they're doing their stuff with rock climbing. And Shatner is climbing on a false facade that they built on location.
He's free soloing.
Yeah, he's free soloing. There was a joke I made on Twitter like a month ago where there's an account.
Did you do the movie stupid thing, the like screenshot?
Yeah, well, there was a an account. Star Trek Out of Context, or whatever it's called. Star Trek Without Context? Star Trek Minus sure. Context, so that's what it
Star
is.
Star Trek Minus.
Yeah.
Star Trek Plus Plus.
Plus Plus Context. No, but they had their... They had a shot from this with Shatner and Nimoy after the jet boots had come in, and had placed that out of context, and I quote tweeted it with the director and cinematographer information from Free Solo and said one perfect shot, which is something I like to do sometimes.
That's good. They're pretty, yes, that's it's a fun internet thing. They're pretty cool looking retro 80s boots that he's got going on there.
They are, mostly because they're ski boots, but he is there. He jets up. And says hi and what's up
He's
and all
like,
that.
What you doing? How are you feeling?
And McCoy, DeForest Kelly, is down on the ground floor of this, looking up at them with the binoculars, the space binoculars, and he's freaking out.
Space binoculars.
He's upset because he's like, you know, people are gonna die.
You're stressing me out, man.
Yeah. So he's not happy, but. Kirk insists to Spock that he will be fine as long as nobody distracts him or breaks his concentration, and then he falls off. And Spock goes after him, and there's a blue screen. You can tell.
It's very fuzzy.
And he's rescued by a set that's at a 90-degree angle that was built to be the forest floor, but you can tell that it's not the forest floor because the leaves on the trees are hanging downwards. Leftwards, I guess, by the time the camera starts out and rotates around.
I did not look with that level of scrutiny.
Well, that's why you're not a Star Trek fan, Dan. He's rescued and he says, hi,
Bones. You should be thankful that I stayed awake for this whole thing.
I believe I warned you that this was not a good movie. Did I say this is a good movie? Did I tell you this is a good movie?
It doesn't mean... It means different things.
Oh, you thought I was just, like, saying this wasn't good in terms of, like, Star Trek lore or something.
We watch a lot of not good movies. Yeah. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be this.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, boy. Anyway, yeah. He falls sideways on a fake 90-degree set. Yeah,
and then they're rescued and whatevs.
And for some reason in this movie, the Enterprise is this carryover from the previous movie? The Enterprise is not fully functional. It's busted up. The doors don't open. The transporter won't work. Like, is there a reason for that?
Well, that's new for this film. At the end of Star Trek IV, which you watched, but it was a long time ago, so I will forgive you not remembering this. The crew approaches it on a little shuttle thingy in space dock and sees it over the hull of the Excelsior. And then they dock with it and get on board and they say, let's go. And the ship goes. And that's the end of that. And then in this one, they are apparently in space dock again because we're using stock footage from that introduction in Star Trek IV. So it's literally the same piece of film. You can see the Excelsior in the foreground as the camera goes over it and reveals the Enterprise. And we have Scotty's monologue slash log, engineer's log, chief engineer's log, about how they, you know, said let's go and then it broke. And so he's trying to fix things. And we cut to him, as you said earlier, in a rehearsal where they were demonstrating that things were broken. And
he's got a glowy stick that he's pointing at stuff, but it's not glowing the right way, which means it's broken.
Mm-hmm. And then Uhura walks on board, and she has two bags of brandless potato chips to share with Scotty.
She's got two tickets to paradise, and while they're doing their tests, they get a phone call, an emergency, level 7 emergency, which must be important because it's a very high number. Scotty's like, I thought we fixed that. And she walks over and pushes a button. She's like, that's not a bug. That's an actual person calling on the phone to be like, we have an emergency, which is in reference to guy on Desert Hole Planet kidnapped. He kidnapped a Romulan, a Klingon, and a human walk into a bar, and a feeling Vulcan says, "Why the long face?" No, I don't know. They're there because this is a peace planet, and it's wherever it's the neutral zone, and everyone can come where ideas can hang out and do whatever, and they can just sort of talk.
You can say like a fine art project.
It is, you know, it's where the galaxy's top negotiators can stop being nice and start getting real. But he kidnaps them by doing basically nothing other than brainwashing everybody.
Yeah, they had 20 guys with makeshift guns coming towards their walled city.
Right, sure.
What
everybody,
are you gonna do?
everybody's you know, stuck together some pieces of PVC and spray painted a certain color, and they're like, aha, better stay away, we got rifles. So they overtook this place and turned everyone into painless zombies or whatever. which is bad. And then he's like, everybody call for help. I've got a plan. We need to get a starship here because I can take us all to... You know, did you watch Futurama?
I've seen most of it, I think.
Did you see the one where David Cross is a planet where everyone gets to go and be happy all the time and in love and stuff?
I did not see that one.
I feel like that episode is a better version of this movie. where he's like some sort of like floating like heaven planet where everyone gets to go and they're all just, it's like paradise or something. But it turns out he's just an alien and like all of his little tentacles he's caressing everyone with is actually his downstairs parts. Fry is the one who's like not super into it. He's like, oh, how come everyone's over there loved up and we're not normal people in it? Anyway, it's so anyway, they get the call and they're like, ah, we got to go. But the Kirk is climbing mountains and he didn't bring his radio and the teleporter's broken. So we got to fly down there with a thing.
The shuttle.
I don't understand the plot purpose of the transporter being broken for the whole movie until the very last minute. Like it doesn't add drama. It doesn't add like a ticking clock or anything. It's just like they just say it a bunch of times.
Well, the plot point is that it's it would have solved a few of their problems if they had the transporter operational.
Because yeah, but it didn't really like make it. I don't know. It didn't really like.
They had lines of dialogue things about how it would make it easier and faster and better, but we don't really like endure a lot of like shuttle travel for prolonged periods of time, so we don't realize how much time it's saving them if they transport things.
And like saving them time doesn't really mean Alexa, stop. Doesn't really mean that it's like pivotal to the plot.
No, of course not. It's mainly when they get to Nimbus 3 and they could beam up the hostages, so they can't. So that's the wrinkle in it. And when they get to the end of the film, where you can go down to the planet surface, if you could just beam everybody back up again when there's a problem, then you've solved your problem. So it doesn't make it as dramatic.
They could have done some bullcrap like the barrier is interfering with their transmission frequencies and we can't teleport anything.
Yes.
I feel like they've used that in other movies.
Well, no, they have. But the problem is Shatner obviously wanted a situation where he was fighting God by himself and everybody got away.
Yes, exactly. And then like when he's like, ah, oh, I can only beam two of you, he's like, oh, take them. And nobody even for a moment is like, no, Jim, you go, you're important. They're just like, all right, cool, I guess we're beaming. And also, you can beam two people at a time. You can't do like round two of beaming and get him on the second trip. Well, it's just you only have enough juice for one.
They could have done round two, except they got hit with the Klingon torpedo.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, but at the same time, I'm just gonna say this was all dumb. Back at the beginning of the movie, the shuttle part played a big thing in what they were doing in terms of like trying to make it seem like they couldn't do certain stuff and that the Enterprise was not in good shape. However, they also did a bunch of like really slapstick stuff to make it seem like the Enterprise was not in good shape. Like the little recorder thingy having the metal faceplate pop off like on a spring.
You mean the metal yearbook that breaks?
Yes, the metal yearbook that breaks. There's other stuff. Voices repeating or things flaring and stuff just making noise. They really went heavy-handed on the Enterprise is not ready for this thing, which makes you question why we had stock footage of the Excelsior right next to the Enterprise.
Well, as the guy said on the TV, there's lots of ships in the area, but none of them have the experience of the newly demoted Captain Kirk, which I read on Wikipedia.
Yes, exactly. I don't know who was in charge of the Excelsior at this point. Presumably, still Stiles. That would have been fun. I feel like maybe you just say, hey, Kirk, you go on this other ship, and then you take the other ship, and stuff, if that's really the case. Because the better way to do it would have been like, you guys are the only ship that could do this right now. But because they're on Earth, which is a far ways away from Nimbus 3, and because they are in space dock with another ship next to them, it does make it seem extra ridiculous that they're up to this challenge. But
why couldn't he be hiking some space capitan or whatever? Like, and the ship is being worked on in the orbit there, so they're just kind of close.
He is a space capitan.
That's funny. Now I wish that they had like a French robot butler on the spaceship.
They have enough. They get on the ship and they're going to go over the thing. And meanwhile, we have Claw, the Klingon Dum Dum, who was over on his ship looking all death metal for nothing.
A little more hair metal than death metal, but yeah.
Yeah, he's got a pendant and some frizzy hair.
He's got big shoulders
and a big five head. And he's lowering periscope to shoot like Pioneer 10 or whatever. He blows up an Earth satellite.
It's the one that had the gold plaque on it with the
yeah, but it wasn't Voyager. It was like a Pioneer or something. I remember the trivia about this, but I don't remember which Pioneer it was.
Hmm. Well, I feel like this is very relevant information that we should live check.
I don't.
Via IMDb trivia. Mm-hmm. Finding satellite.
Did you spell satellite correctly?
Yeah, it's not on the IMDb trivia.
Oh no, what are we going to do?
Well, what we're going to do is we're going to go over to the Wikipedia trivia page.
Gosh darn it.
And we're going to go satellite. God, I can't type on this keyboard. I don't see it here either.
Oh no, it must not be important.
Oh, no.
If only there was some way to know.
Star Trek V satellite. What's Pioneer 10?
Oh, it was a Pioneer.
Yeah.
Who could have guessed?
Not me.
back to the movie. They blow it up with a down periscope blow up thing. It's remarkably difficult for him to hit a barely moving object, but they do it. And he's all excited about this, but they intercept, his first officer intercepts the distress call from Nimbus 3, and the captain's like, oh no, distress call, but that means the Federation will also be sending somebody so I can shoot them. Finally, better target practice than Pioneer 10. And so they set course as well. But the important part is that we have...
Why are the Klingons in this movie? I mean, aside from like, oh, I add a little bit of peril to the end of the movie, they don't do anything. They don't need to be here.
They complicate things.
Yeah, but in the exact same way a couple of times.
Yes. What is kind of sad about it is that... no one seems to anticipate the ways that they could complicate things, which is not great because it kind of makes everybody look like dum-dums.
Yeah, they're all exhibiting one-dimensional thinking in this movie.
They sure are. But the Enterprise gets to Nimbus 3 first, and Kirk assembles an away team of mainly all of his senior staff, and just leaves Chekov in charge. And they all go down to the surface in a shuttle. Then there is an attempt to distract and subdue the perimeter patrol people who are out on the dunes or whatever at a rest stop. And they're all hanging out. And then they start to hear a song about the gate to heaven and stuff. And it's a fan dance from Nichelle Nichols.
Damn. She's naked. What? For the eyes of my mother. Hello, boys. I've always wanted to play to a captive audience.
I honest to God, I thought it was going to be like Bones or Spock doing that dance.
That would have been funny.
It would have.
With Nichelle Nichols, it just kind of gets kind of awkward.
Yeah, I didn't realize she was like on the mission with them there.
Yeah, well, she is. She's capable of being a distraction, I suppose. It would have been nice to see her like competence as an officer more than this. But anyway, she distracts them with her fan dance, and they are subdued. And then they take their horrible, gross burlap sacks and their blue horses with horns, and then they ride them into Paradise City because they wanna have somebody take them down to Paradise City where the dust is brown and the girls are kitties.
Oh no. I was going to say the horse is blue, but that works well with the kitty. Anyway, and the whole reason they hijack the horses is because the Klingons will be here in an hour and a half, and it'll take us about an hour and a half to walk the distance. So he's like, aha, we got to get there fast, so now, let's steal some horses.
The real reason they stole horses is because William Shatner loves horses, and he has a lot of horses. And he likes riding horses, and he likes using horses whenever he can use horses in things. And
did he bring his personal horse?
I don't know if any of these were his personal horse as much as they were showbiz horses, because I assume you need to do tricks and also be dyed blue. But there are horses there, and he gets to ride them, so he's happy.
Of course.
Yeah. It's worth pointing out... there's a Star Trek movie I will never probably make you watch because of its mediocrity, which is Star Trek Generations.
I feel like you're getting ahead of yourself there just based on what we're doing right now. Like, yeah. We are fully on a descent into...
See, the funny thing is, there's a big bounce back after this where it gets good again, because Star Trek VI is good and Star Trek V is bad. But To paraphrase Harv Bennett, this almost killed the franchise. Or I believe that might be a direct quote, but I just don't have it in front of me. This almost killed the franchise. This almost killed everything because they had a huge opening weekend and then an immediate sharp drop off. Whereas Star Trek IV had a smaller opening weekend, but was in movie theaters for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks. And people loved going to see it, even if they didn't care. About
people like whales. People like whales.
And the 80s-ness of it was fun, and the fish out of water aspect of it. So you had kind of different things where they did not build upon the things that interested people from the previous movie and may have alienated people who went to go see this. So they had a huge opening weekend and then a very sharp, steep, precipitous drop-off. And so nobody really had any interest in things after this for Star Trek.
I believe it.
Yeah. But Star Trek Generations, which comes after the next movie, has Shatner in it. And he rides a horse because he can, I guess, dictate these sorts of things that he gets horses. He does. He rides a horse. So Shatner and horses. I don't know what the deal is, but he loves them. Loves them, wants to be with them, wants to have them on a set, wants to ride them in the movie. Wants to show everybody he can ride a horse. We get it. We're completely on board. We figured it out. But anywho, they ride their blue horses with horns into Paradise City, and then the guy with dental issues from the beginning of the movie says, "Hey, who are those guys?" And then they turn their mirror with a light on it. On them, and then Sulu has to like dodge a bazooka and then roll and blow up the mirror. And then there is some
And then they start fighting back, and then the feeling Spock is like, no, I didn't want bloodshed. I just wanted to trick you to come here so I could brainwash you and steal your ship.
Yeah.
He's like, you guys started it.
Yeah. Also, what's weird is he was in the room that Kirk walks into later and is not in that room anymore because I guess he goes into the back room and tells the ambassadors what to do to pull the wool over everybody's eyes. But anywho...
Yeah, he's pulling the strings. He wants his dramatic reveal as he comes out of the shadows. He wants it to look like the kidnappees are the kidnappers, but not really.
Yeah. So there's some bad fight choreography that occurs here, and then Kirk gets inside of the bar and puts his gun away and is just walking around at a leisurely pace when all of a sudden the cat lady springs over the bar. And he wrestles with her and then flings her into the pool table, which is an actual pool of water.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cats hate water.
I guess. I guess cats hate water so much that they instantly die when they touch it.
Yes. She could have had an allergy. But
a water allergy?
Water allergy. You don't know.
She banished herself to the driest planet.
She's an alien. You don't know how she is.
You're saying she's a dry ice based life form.
Or
she's the Wicked Witch of the East's cat or something.
Well, it fit your criticism of a later thing. But so anyway,
is the Wicked Witch, was she in the East?
Well, there was a Wicked Witch of the East and a Wicked Witch of the West.
Well, which was the bad green one?
The West. The East died when the house fell on her, and the shoes are the ones that Dorothy wears.
Right, right. It's
almost like you're not gay, but anyway. So they do their thing.
I haven't watched that movie since I was like 10.
Yeah, it's fine. So they do their thing, and the ambassadors, David Warner, etc., walk out, and they. They like lower your weapons and stuff. You're like, you're under arrest. And so they capture Kirk and Spock, and so everybody gives up. And then they all take the shuttle up. But by this point, the Klingon Bird of Prey has cloaked and is near the ship. And so the ship can't lower its shields to let the shuttle in. And this gives us another reason why they get the little tension thing out of the shuttle. But unfortunately, they have
15.5 whole seconds to take the shield down and then to use the tractor beam to pull the shuttle in. So what we're going to do is we're going to fly right at it, and then at the very last second, they're going to, like, turn the shield off or a blip, and then we're going to fly right through it, and then you turn right back on.
Yeah. Most of their distraction seems to have been from Kirk actually announcing that he was on the shuttle, because then... The Klingon captain, who is a dum-dum, said to alter their targeting so that they could fire on the shuttle. And then we get a graphic of a white spray-painted shuttle shot on a screen because they couldn't actually afford to do anything computer-generated. So the Klingon Bird of Prey is closing in on the shuttle. The shuttle, Kirk says, let's do emergency landing plan B. And then everybody pauses and say, what's that? And he says... B, as in barricade, and Scotty says, you can't be serious. And then they do their thing, where they initiated a comedy routine as they slam on the gas to fly into the Enterprise. They drop the shields, and the shuttle crash lands into the set that was used for the throne room in Coming to America. And then...
It just goes to show you that... kids these days with their technology just don't understand how to pilot a ship the way they used to in their parents' ages, because Sulu's never flown a ship manually before, so he's like, I don't know, we're probably going to crash, maybe.
Well, I don't think he's flown a ship manually into a shuttle bay with like full gas.
Didn't look that hard. You just line it up, point it straight, and then they're just going to do the shield thing.
Yeah, until they, like, crash the lower part. So that's good. They didn't, like, hit the little lip thing more and destroy the interior cockpit.
Yeah.
But anyway, they crash. They land. And the barricade goes up. The net that catches them. The Klingons shoot and miss because Chekhov wisely decides to initiate a little warp thing, so they go and miss it.
Right, yeah. He very slowly warps out of the way just in time.
Yes. I have to say that is more on the effects speed of what was happening and less on his direction of what to do. But it does appear very slow, the actual torpedo. It seems to be moving at a leisurely pace. But they get out of there, and everybody starts waking up. Kirk gets out, and he has a gun, and he fights Cybok. And by fight Cybok, I mean Cybok flings him on a wire into several things. And then Spock gets out there, and he gets the gun, and he can shoot Cybok, but Cybok says, "You're going to have to shoot me," and then he doesn't. And Kirk's mad, and he says, "Shoot him!" With an echoey, reverberate shout, which lets you know that he means business.
Yeah, he's like, you could have solved this whole thing right here and freed us from the captor. You could just shoot your brother.
It doesn't happen.
We don't know yet that he's his brother, or we do yet? No.
We do not know yet.
They gotta go to the room with the ship wheel with the plaque on it.
No, that it's in the brig.
Oh, the plaque is in the brig?
No. The revelation is in the brig. The plaque is in the wheel room.
The revelation's in the brig.
Yeah. So they all get skedaddled to the brig. And Spock, for whatever reason, says he's going to go with his friends rather than going to the bridge where he could maybe manipulate things or have some sort of influence over the events. But instead, he decides that his best use case is to be locked up. So they
choose sides.
They get locked inside the brig, and the little globy bars go up, and they're stuck in there. And there are some lines about how they say that the Federation tested with the most resourceful person that they could find, but he was not able to get out, so this is escape proof. And they say, didn't happen to be you. And he's like, yep, me. So it's me. But in terms of the brotheriness, he does have a dialogue here with Kirk, who says, "I happen to know for a fact you don't have a brother." And he says, "This is technically true. I don't have a brother. I have a half-brother." And it was from a Vulcan princess that Sarek had previously been married to before he was married to Amanda, who was his mom. Kirk says he needs to sit down. And so he hits the button for the toilet, and there's a little placard that says, "Do not use while in space talk," which is amusing. But they have their thing where he reveals this.
Was it actually a push-button toilet?
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was just a chair. A weird chair.
Oh, no.
It comes out of the wall.
It was absolutely a toilet. He pushes the button, and a thing slides out, and there is a top lid to it. It is a toilet. It is a space toilet for your brig to poop. For your space prisoner poop. But they chat some more about this stuff and try to escape and whatever, but there is a Morse code, and they don't figure out what it is until they need to actually know what the message is, which is to stand back. And you gotta love the cliche of using Morse code, because who knew how useful Morse code would be many hundreds of years into the future.
I knew what he was typing before they got to the back part, so I probably would have.
Wait,
been okay.
I'm sorry, Dan.
No, I don't. I don't know Morse code, but if you hear "stand," the next one's probably going to be "back."
Oh, okay. I wanted to make sure you didn't actually know Morse code, because
I don't actually know Morse code.
It just would have had a problem with you after that. But they stand back far too late, and it explodes in a perfectly haphazardly welded line, and reveals Scotty, who says, "Don't you know a jailbreak when you see one?" And they all pile through the door, and he tells them the instructions to use the turbo lift to get to the emergency transmitter, and then he says, "I know the ship like the back of my hand," and then he walks into a beam and falls over. And apparently,
which
James,
is very stupid and not funny at all.
No, apparently James Doohan was not a huge fan of that and thought it made the character Scotty look dumb.
It did.
Yeah.
It's kind of the sort of thing that maybe our current Scotty would do, but not him.
No. Also, I don't think you can call him a current Scotty anymore because they're not really making those movies anymore. But
are they done?
They canceled the one that was in production because of funding disputes, and there is something that is maybe going on with Quentin Tarantino, but Quentin Tarantino won't commit to saying anything about it until after he's done with his...
Well, he said he's only going to make like 10 whole movies, and he probably had them all laid out already, and now he's got to decide whether or not he's going to go back on his word and make an 11th movie and look really stupid to all of his followers. Or if he's just going to, he's going to not do it out of pride. Stupid, stupid pride.
Or if he just writes it.
Yeah, I could see that, but.
Yeah. But anyway, they're doing their thing. They get to the turbo lift elevator shaft where the glowing horizontal lines are all. You know when you go to a doctor's office, an optometrist's office, and they have all those glasses lying out on those plastic racks, the ones that used to rotate on like three things, those ones, and they had the little ridges and stuff in the middle to hold the glasses. That's what makes up all of the lights that are inside of the turbo lift. Yes.
Well, I mean, you know, it's creative production design or something, right?
Herman's very resourceful, but they
and Thera.
but they also managed to use some black lines to cleverly hide where they might have certain mount points for things. But Kirk and McCoy start climbing up, and then Scotty disappears through a door at the bottom of the shaft, and then he reappears later by flying downwards. So I don't know how he did that, because I would assume that he ascended the levels through some other means, and then went down to them.
Did you say Scotty or Spock?
Spock.
Yeah, Spock.
Yes.
He's got his boots on again.
Yes, he's got his climbing boots. And
his
so,
boots are made for flying.
That's just what they do.
It's, you know, it's the three of them hop on together, and they have a nice little flight. Well,
the boosters, they gotta use the boosters.
Yeah, initially, they don't have enough fizzy lifting drink to get them up. And then he's like, hit the gas. And he's like, we're going to go real fast, and that'll be dangerous. He's like, do it anyway, because I'm Shatner, and everything's going to be okay. And they do it, and then they almost crash. But he manages to yell stop at the perfect moment so they don't crash, which is, you know, the mark of a true captain,
and
knowing when to yell stop.
Also, Spock gets to say, I overshot it by one level, and McCoy says, nobody's perfect, which is kind of not great for all of three of those reasons. But they descend, and like it would have been fine, would have been funny if you had the Kirk and the, if you had the Spock and the McCoy lines. But having the Kirk line, the Spock line, and the McCoy line, not good. But anyway, they descend, they get to the thing, they go to the emergency transmitter. They push the button that makes the thing come out of the floor, and then they push the other button that makes the thing come out of the top of the thing that came out of the floor, and then they are going to talk to it, and they reach somebody who's Starfleet, and it's not Starfleet. Dun-dun-dun! It is Muscly...
It's the Klingon lady with the hair.
Yeah, the Muscly Klingon lady with the hair and no eyebrows. And she says, yeah, sure, totally. Send us your coordinates. And the coordinates are 000 Mark 2. And for those not familiar with the Star Trek coordinate convention, the mark is like an angle, and the 000 is like a 3D space Cartesian thing from the galactic center. So they're saying go to origin, along this angle of two, which doesn't make any sense, but whatever, they do it. They're doing the thing. And they get caught by Cybok and his desert army as they walk in the doors. And Cybok says, well, there's nothing you can do about it now. We're going to almost to the Great Barrier. This is my plan for Shakari and Eden and whatever. And that's what this is. And Cybok says, the bond between you is especially strong, so I'm just going to start with you guys and, you know, try to figure it out. And he says, your pain's the worst. And he goes with DeForest Kelly first as Bones. And he reveals a scene.
This scene is so long.
Yeah. I feel like the scene is emotionally effective if you're invested in these characters, but at the same time, it is especially theatrical, like in the execution sense.
Yeah, it's very much like a miniature stage play on its own.
Yeah.
It's long. It is effective, but like we got it and then it kept going. And he's like, "But wait, there's more." It's like, "No, please no."
No. Like, and what's really weird is like McCoy does this thing and he has to kill his own father basically by, you know, his father doesn't want to experience pain. He has to take him off of life support. And yeah, he does that.
And the Death Star is going to blow up. There's not that much time left.
That's not the same. But anyway, it was you know, fine for what it was. But he takes him off the life support, and then it goes to Spock, and Spock's like, no, whatever. And then Kirk's like, no, it's fine. Go ahead and do it. And then afterwards, Kirk's like, you're going to be brainwashed by this con man? And it's like, you told him to do the thing. You said be brainwashed. You let him brainwash you. But anyway, Kirk is too good to be brainwashed or shown anything about his past. I thought it would have been really effective had it been something related to David, or related to Genesis, or related to anything to do with Carol Marcus when they first met or something, or when they broke up. But they decided not to go any of those routes and to just leave Kirk as like this perfect person who cannot be broken by this con man.
He's defiant in the face of the televangelist who's telling him what he does and doesn't need to do to cleanse himself of his pain and his sadness and stuff. And he's like, ah, no, makes me who I am.
Yes.
Ah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Honestly, we could maybe use a little bit of a sanitized Kirk.
I need my pain. Which is, I have to say, one of my favorite lines, not because I love it or love the scene or anything.
I've quoted that many times. Now I know that that's from this movie.
Yeah. Yeah. That was an important part of making you watch this, I guess. But he needs his pain.
Now I get your internet jokes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, what a joy for you! But they're broken up by the call that they've reached the Great Barrier, and so he needs to go do the thing. And so Cybok's like, "Everybody, may join me on the bridge," and everybody's like, "No, we're gonna stay with Kirk." And he's like, "All right, fine, whatever." And so they go up to the bridge, and Cybok is looking at it as they go through the chemicals and the salt tank, I guess, and it looks so sad, so really incredibly sad, not special or difficult or anything. They just kind of fly through like blooming oil bubbles, and then they arrive on the other side. And
yeah, the whole thing where, spoiler alert, the Wizard of Oz is going like, your journey must have been difficult. And he's like, yes, it was. It's like, what part?
Yeah,
the gentle brainwashing, the tricking of the guys to let you borrow the ship, because certainly not flying through the barrier. That wasn't difficult.
No, it was super easy. There was no difficulty. There was no challenge posed by that. There was no damage. There was no threat or danger or anything. I feel like they should have at least done something. Making it seem worthless was weird. But anyway, they get through the Great Barrier. And reach the planet Shakari that Cybok had been looking for, which is supposed to be synonymous with other forms of Eden or paradise or whatever. And they see it, and it's sort of like a blue sun thing. And they orbit it, and Chekhov says he senses tremendous power down on the planet. And they talk about that stuff, and then all of a sudden Kirk comes up the elevator, and he arrives from the turbo lift on the bridge, and he says, you know, well, we're here now, so I might as well go down, and I'll be in charge, and let's do the thing. Let's do it by the books. Let's meet God by the books, and whatever. it's a weird turn, because it's basically saying, like, all right, well, we went through this completely non-challenging thing that didn't cost us anything, and orbited this planet, and now I'm just going to go along with the madman's plans because I have to, and this is a barely functioning ship, and we're theoretically under threat, and there are several hostages on board. Anyway, he's just like, yeah, sure, might as well, since we're here. And so they pile onto the other shuttle, the Copernicus, and take that down. And they land at Trona Peaks, which is near I guess, the Mojave Desert, where they shot the other location shoot stuff. And Lawrence Luckenbill has a different haircut and different bathrobe that he's wearing. And
yeah, I thought he like took off his like metal plating or whatever, and he has that was like his summer weather bathrobe that's not as hot when he's out there.
It's similar to what Spock was wearing in his Star Trek IV thing.
The terry cloth robe.
Yeah, and so. They have that, and everybody else is in their uniforms, but they all have haircuts, and they land, and they go outside, and he's talked into leaving his phaser behind, and Kirk and everybody walks after the shuttle had been guided to a specific spot. They walk to a place that Sybok had seen in his visions, I guess, because then they just stop and wait. And then all of a sudden, pillars come up from the ground and form like a rib cage kind of a thing around them.
Yeah.
And then they're back on a set on the Paramount lot.
Yeah, they're standing inside of a rib cage, which somehow also has... It looked like it had a roof, but maybe it just kind of sort of got dark at the same time, too. But
oh,
whatever.
Yeah. No, it went dark. You could see the sun... go out, extinguish, basically, because they dissolved out of that and changed the exposure. But it is definitely 100% a transition to a set. Like, there is nothing about that makes you feel like they're on location still. But they have God appear as a blue, misty, whatever thing on the floor, and then it shoots up into this big glowing column. There's a rotating light, which provides the fluctuating beam. And then there's a bunch of like really weird reverse developed negative photography stuff that flies at you. It's different images of different gods. And then finally, our guy with baloney curl, Fu Manchu, shows up. It's like, yeah, so how'd you guys do it? And he says, oh, well, we got a starship. And it's like, great. Could this starship carry my wisdom? Sure. Great, bring it down to the planet so that I may join with it.
Wait, can the starship carry my wisdom? Sounds like such a great euphemism.
I mean, you're already married, Dan. I don't think you need to use that line. But have the moment where Kirk is the only one who realizes that this is strange and speaks up and says, what does God need with a starship? And this is another famous line from this particularly bad movie. He's just asking the question. McCoy...
Simple question. Just answer the question.
McCoy comes up and says, you don't ask the Almighty for his ID. And the God is like, who's this guy? What's he want? What's going on with him? And Kirk's like, yeah, well, don't you know? Aren't you God? They have a little tiff. They have a little spat where God shoots laser bolt eyes at him, and then he falls over, but not dead, just like moderately wounded.
He scorches his uniform in the center there.
Yeah, he gets a squib. And then Cybok's all like, why'd you do that? Why'd you hurt my guy? And the God's like, well, do you doubt me? And he talks to Spock, and he's like, yeah, sure, totally doubt you. And then he gets shot. But he kind of shot off camera because he couldn't afford another lightning bolt, I guess, where he just kind of falls over and then gets back up again. God asks McCoy if he doubts him, and McCoy says, I would doubt any God that would inflict pain. And
spoiler alert for him, there's a lot of that.
Yeah.
And all of the histories.
Yeah.
All of the gods.
Yeah.
He's going to be really bummed when he reads about stuff like the Crusades.
Maybe he wasn't so well-versed. But Cybok's all like, well, reveal yourself to me. Why would you do this? And then the eye zooms in, and then Cybok walks out in negative blue talks to other Cybok, and then is like, isn't this what you wanted? Isn't this, you know, what you thought God would be? It would be you. Kind of a criticism. They wrestle. They wrestle in God's light beam, and everybody escapes, and Kirk calls down a photon torpedo to kill not just God, but Cybok, who is wrestling him. But anyway, so this is the moment where Kirk murders Spock's half-brother that he didn't know about until this movie. And it doesn't seem to affect or phase Spock at all. But the half-brother's murdered here with a torpedo. And then God's not dead and comes after them. But they get back to the shuttle. And then everybody's beamed out except for Kirk, who gets to go against God by himself. And God starts eating the shuttle, but something sparks flying everywhere. And then Kirk is just running. But meanwhile, back on the Enterprise, Spock gets up to the bridge. They're hailed by the Bird of Prey, who wants to demand their surrender because they shot them when they were beaming them, the other guys up. And Spock says, says to Cord that you're his superior officer, do something about it. And Cord's like, I'm just a foolish old man. He's like, damn you, sir, do something. And so he does and manages to talk the other guy into having the Bird of Prey go fight God. And so then the Bird of Prey goes up over the bridge behind Kirk and shoots God in the face and blows God up after Kirk had been running away from God for a little bit by free climbing, I guess, which doesn't seem like an efficient way to get away from God, but he does it somehow. And then God blows up good. And then Kirk is beamed on board the Klingon ship and taken to the bridge where he talks to Cord, and the captain apologizes for his behavior. And then Cord introduces the new gunner, who turns around and it's Spock. And then Spock says, you were never going to die because you were never alone. And they hug and he says, please, Captain, not in front of the Klingons. And then they all go have a cocktail party back on the Enterprise where they're chilling out and having fun, having a good time because they got brainwashed. Yay! And they're happy they killed God at the center
it's
of the
not
universe.
One of those movies where you kill the bad guy and then all of the stuff that he had done like disappears in an instant. So like they didn't all get their pain back once Cyborg Locke dies.
No, once Cyborg dies, it seems that Cyborg's influence may have waned. Also, they may have not been as convinced without his presence to do these things, since that was ultimately Cyborg's goal, was this sort of religious goal.
So he is a drug, like it fades and you got to keep doing more in order to maintain your high, but once he's gone it goes away.
Yeah. But anywho, he's gone and they're all in their thing, they're having their cocktail party, and Spock has one throwaway line about missing Cyborg, and it's like, okay, it really like shattered you. They finish the movie and that's it, and credits and stuff. So bad. So ridiculously bad.
Nothing happens in this movie.
Would you believe that there were 15 minutes that were cut out by Paramount?
I was just about to ask if it was plot related, but I'm sure it was just more of Shatner like congratulating himself.
I believe it was. You see, basically, Shatner's cut came in at 2 hours, and then the studio said that's too long, and then they told Harve Bennett to cut it down, and then Harve Bennett cut it down to 1 hour and 45, and then Shatner was like, no, you can't do that to my baby. And so then they negotiated and they got some stuff back in and some other stuff taken out, and so they got to an hour and 47 minutes. They did that. I don't know if there's much that would have saved it. A lot of what was actually cut was the visual effects that were removed from the picture.
Random Sterling Dan in the chat says they cut an additional 10 minutes of campfire sing along.
Well, one of the things they cut was there were supposed to be rock monsters that chased William Shatner.
In Galaxy Quest.
Yeah, when God was injured, he supposedly animated these rock monsters, but they could only afford one rock monster, and they made one rock monster suit and they shot it on location, and apparently the flamethrower part of the rock monster suit didn't work, and then the part where smoke went through a tube and then out of the rock monster's seams to sort of obscure the rubber seams of the rock monster, that didn't work because the wind blew it away. And so all they had was a sad guy in a rubber suit, and they didn't know what to do with it. So he was cut completely from the movie. And he asked Bran Farron to do something. And Bran Farron said, well, here's this shape-shifting amorphous god blob that I'm going to put in here. And Shatter said, that's not good. That doesn't do it for me. And then the editor apparently just said, let's just chop out the whole thing and basically replace almost all of it with stuff that they didn't need. Apparently a main source of confusion for audiences in the first test screening was, how did Spock get on the Klingon ship? And why did the Klingons not shoot them or kill them or do anything? So that was apparently something that they needed to clarify.
Well, I just assumed that Scotty actually fixed the transporter, which he was working on. He said he promised to get it fixed.
Yeah. But they didn't. I mean, it would have been more interesting, I think, had they just beamed everybody up and then God like ascended from the planet's surface and became something that the ship had to shoot at. But I don't think they had the budget for that. Or
like at the end of Men in Black 2, where Serlina turns into a giant snake face and pops out of the building and they have to blast it before it eats what's her name?
That's sort of a snake poison ivy thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But like in terms of a giant head like flying towards space unexpectedly that they have to blast at the last minute.
Yeah, I just mean there should have been something that they did that involved the entire crew. The ending, much like
Like teamwork, where they work together?
Yeah, because the ending, much like the rest of this film, feels an awful lot like Shatner going, I'm perfect and great. just let me do my thing.
This movie is kind of the outline for Galaxy Quest kind of by itself, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It sure is. And you definitely get a lot of those tensions animated here for you by this film. And it's unintentionally funny in places where things are bad that should not be as bad as they are. There are some attempts at comedy in here, but they mainly fall flat for the most part. I don't think that this movie really nailed it by any stretch of the imagination.
What?
I think it alienated fans and also alienated people who may have been approaching this because they liked Star Trek IV or liked Star Trek The Next Generation, which just came out recently. Because I remember the Herman, the set guy, he was from Star Trek The Next Generation. He was hired by Shatner because of his work that he did for that. And I have to say, the sets look better than they did 4 years ago. Because we just talked about Star Trek III, even though we talked about Star Trek IV many years ago.
Yes.
And Star Trek III
back
really,
when you thought you would never get me to watch more than one Star Trek.
I know. And who knew I could blow out on this? But they had... How should I say this? That movie, like you said at the time, that movie feels like it's the 70s. And Star Trek 4 feels like it's the 80s because they're literally in the 80s. And then Star Trek 5 feels more modern-ish for the most part. It doesn't feel as dated. So I would say maybe early 90s if I was being generous. So that's something going in its favor. Also, the director of photography on this, the cinematographer, not as bad as 3.
They overcame their technical and creative difficulties with the Brown movie and turned it into a movie that looks like a movie.
Yeah, but at the same time, there's nothing in here that makes me go, "Ooh, wow, hire this guy." It just seems competent for the most part, which is good. There is some stuff with barrel distortion and the anamorphic whatevers that make things super fuzzy, especially when the claw, the Klingon captain is talking to his first officer, who is behind him, and she's slightly out of focus, and her whole head is like this sort of greenish, bokeh-ish blob, which is weird. But then it sort of fades back into focus because they rack on her. But it's very weird, some of the choices. But for the most part, a big improvement over Star Trek III, which felt incredibly cheap in those terms. And you had the return of Jerry Goldsmith, who I like his score, even though meh. I wouldn't draft it for anything, for like a special thing. There's a lot of like, there's also a lot of comedy stuff in the score itself, like almost like a Warner Brothers cartoon, like especially when Kirk says B for barricade, and there's like a, I don't know, like sort of like a dulcimer, like bell hum kind of a noise that occurs for the punchline of that, which is not an accent that I need really for getting comedy of the moment, but that's there. I like the Klingon theme, which was in the Star Trek the Motion Picture stuff, but it's like at a faster tempo where it seems more dramatic as opposed to the Klingon the Motion Picture version of the Klingon introduction, where the Klingon stuff is very slow. Like, imagine that music for the Klingons, the dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun, except just like really slow. Dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun. It like just really slow. But Jerry Goldsmith would not return for the next two movies. You would see different composers for those, and then you would see Jerry Goldsmith return for the seventh movie in the franchise, the second Next Generation movie, Star Trek First Contact. And then he would do the rest of the Next Generation movies.
What are the Next Generation movies? Are those Picard movies?
Yes, Picard movies. You may not realize this, Dan, but you are most of the way through.
Yeah, I feel like we have momentum now, and whether we continue to go right now, I feel like we're going to watch the rest of these stupid movies.
Well, that was my intention. took advantage of your weakness.
4 years, but you finally tricked me.
Yeah, because
it's only fair. How many John Landis movies have I made you watch?
Two? Three.
Oh,
three.
Well, then we're in three?
I think so. Right?
I don't know. I'm not keeping track of this stuff.
You can add more John Landis movies. We can do American Werewolf in London, I guess, at some point.
Oh, boy.
But there's only one more Star Trek Original Series cast one for the full cast, and that is Star Trek The Undiscovered Country, Star Trek VI, directed by Nicholas Meyer, who was the guy who did Star Trek II and wrote all of the 1980s stuff that was in Star Trek IV. You know, he didn't direct that one. I don't know. May space it out, pun intended, so that you don't get overwhelmed. Or maybe I will mercifully suggest that we do Star Trek VI just to cleanse your palate so that you don't feel like you are weighed down by this as you're...
I don't know. That's not a palate cleanser in any sense. I would just as well let sleeping Treks lie or whatever, but if it's the last of the original series people, then maybe it's fine, whatever. I don't care. Yeah.
There is
I don't care if six is actually good, Dan. I don't believe you either. You're both trying to trick me.
I like for a moment there where I forgot that you're talking to Dan in the chat room, and I thought you were just talking to yourself.
Yeah, I'm talking to myself. It's a personal affirmation. No, not good. Not good.
Yeah. No, but six is a good send-off, but unfortunately they have a few of the cast members return for the kickoff for the Picard movies, as you called them. Where they sort of pass
where
the torch.
Old people make up and sort of shake hands with each other and stuff?
Worse than that. It's a flashback and then some time travel. But
time travel's interesting. I finally watched Avengers. There's time travel.
Ah, spoiler alert.
Really?
I mean, at this point, probably not. But I was just joking. But I was a little peeved when I saw that before I went to go watch it, before it even came out in theaters. The Los Angeles Times had like run some thing talking about the big twist of them using that to solve their problem. And I was just like, but why would you say that? The movie is not even in theaters yet. Why would you say the thing?
I feel like one of the least surprising things about the movie is that there's a time travel component, but you probably shouldn't get into that.
No. But anywho, Star Trek V, The Final Frontier, which it was not,
It was not.
Definitely not. And they went through a barrier, and it was not that great, in spite of its name. And
they should have named the hologram God person Reef.
As in the Great Barrier Reef?
Yeah, he could have been Reef from the Great Barrier.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Dan, for that insight. You're, that would have saved this movie. Welcome.
It would have, yes. It would have given a little bit of something to the third act.
Some oomph.
A little bit of oomph. A little bit of flavor sprinkled in there.
Yeah. Oh, man.
It's over.
On that note, let's wrap this Klingon cocktail party hors d'oeuvre up.
Mm. When you said wrap it in Klingon, it sounded like cling wrap, wrap.
Yes, cling wrap your targs. I don't know. I don't know what they serve at a Klingon cocktail party.
What's a targ?
It's like a dog thing.
A targ is a Klingon dog?
Kind of.
Wait, is that the greasy thing from the previous movie that blew up?
No, I think it was a different thing. But anyway, it doesn't matter.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
Sort of like a warthog dog kind of thing.
How much time have you spent on the Star Trek wiki reading all of this crap?
Sometimes reading helps you stay limber
mentally.
Just
answer the question, sir. Answer the question.
I don't have an answer. It's a long time.
Do you read the Star Trek wiki every day before bed to help you fall asleep?
No, I don't. But sometimes I'll start reading something. I'll be like, whoa, I remember that episode was on. And then I remember that. And I remember that. And then I start tapping through different things. And then I'll be like, well, this is how many disruptors are on this ship class. And I'm like, this is not the kind of information that I need.
You're like, I remember that episode. High five, self.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, this has been fun, and I'm grateful that you indulged me. And this is a movie that's not very long, and it's painfully awful, but it is like ripping off a Band-Aid. We're done with it now, and we never have to deal with it again, and it's gone.
Thank goodness. I'm very happy that it is gone.
Yeah, and it's going to make some of the things that I will say about other things make sense. So that's good. But at the same time, probably not worth you watching it in like a greater like cosmic sense. But well. So is much of the stuff that we do.
Yeah. One of these days we'll figure out like a theme or a through line for the movies that we watch.
Yeah, maybe we could do it by month, where we come up with some sort of clever pun for the month.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Joe Rosenberry. Something like a cereal. Did we end? If I had a marshmallow, yes, I've had a marshmallow.
But did you call it a marshmallow for some weird reason?
Oh, no. You know, honestly, when the thing came out of the little doodad, it kind of looked like the little egg machine from Doom by Friday. He farted out an egg marshmallow.
Oh, man. Yeah, no, that seems bad. it just really always got me. They said marshmallow.
I definitely caught that he said marshmallow. I was very much paying attention.